he said. You recommended me to a guy who turned out to be a deadbeat. I did the work and submitted a report. That was June 15th. No response. I billed again July, and he called, which was nice of him. He claimed the client was a slow pay, and if he didn't get the money that week, he'd pay me himself and collect from the client after the fact. Sounded good to me, so I waited. Still nothing. I bill again in August, and the mail bounces back. Big block letters, return to sender. I try calling, and the number's a disconnect. I can't get through to you, so here I am. He stared at me, and I stared back. I have no idea what you're talking about, I said. Walensky, Pete, the P.I. Well, it's no wonder you never heard from him. He's dead. Since when? August 25th. He was shot during a robbery attempt and died at the scene. Would have been nice if you'd let me know. I squinted. Why would I do that? Because you gave him my name and he subbed out a job to me. I didn't give Pete your name. Yes, you did. That was the first thing he said. He said I sent you? When was this? May, a week before Memorial Day. He said he ran into you downtown and asked if you knew a Nevada PI. You suggested me. I haven't talked to Pete in years. I'd never give him your name or number for any reason at all. The man's a scumbag. He said he worked with you at Birdshine. He did not. He never worked at Birdshine. I had nothing to do with giving him your number. Well, if you didn't send him, who did? How would I know? I only agreed because of you. I wouldn't have taken the job otherwise. Have you been listening to anything I said? He might have claimed I referred him, but that doesn't make it true. How'd he hear about me, then? Maybe another PI in town. You're the only one I know. I lowered my voice, feigning calm. I have not talked to Pete since Morley Shine died. And that was 5 years ago. I ran into him at the funeral, where he was trolling for business. In the midst of my protest, I felt a spark of recall and held up a hand. Uh-oh. Wait. Dietz said. What? I just remembered. I got a call from Con Dolan who said someone needed a Nevada PI. He asked for your phone number, and I gave it to him. This was months ago. I told him I had no idea if you were still in business, but he was free to try. It didn't occur to me to ask what it was about. I knew you liked Con, and he liked you, so it all seemed okay. That's probably it, then. My dumb luck. I'm sorry. Honestly, if I'd known it was Pete, I wouldn't have said a word. Henry got up and poured me another glass of wine. Dietz had already reached for the bottle of blackjack that was sitting in the middle of the table. He topped off his glass, and when Henry held out his tumbler, Dietz filled that as well. The silence was dense. I couldn't quite meet his eye. How much does he owe you? $3,000 and change. Another silence accumulated while I pondered the sum. $3,000 would have seemed like a lot prior to my windfall of $500,000. All a matter of perspective, isn't it? For doing what? Surveillance. Who's the client? Some young fellow here in town suspected his wife was having an affair with an old flame. This guy's wife and her old boyfriend both now work at the same research firm. The two were flying to Reno for a conference, and I guess hubby wanted to know if they were up to no good. Were they? Not that I saw. The two didn't interact at all. She met with an old high school buddy, and they put their heads together on two occasions, but there was nothing romantic going on. I sent Pete my report and an itemized expense account with all of the receipts attached. This was 4 full days' work, and I invoiced him accordingly. You want his office address? I have it already. That's where I sent my bill. I'll take a run over there on Monday and see what's what. Maybe his partner can fill me in. I don't think Pete had a partner. Of course he did. Abel, as in Abel and Walensky. That's probably a ruse on his part to net a favorable position in the phone book. Shit, Dietz said. I still have his unlisted home phone in an old address book. I don't remember the number offhand, but I know where he lives.
Never mind, not your problem, he said.
Of course it is. I should have asked Con what was going on and then cleared it with you before I passed your number along.
Dietz said, wouldn't have made any difference. If I'd known the request came from Con, I'd have agreed. Besides which, Pete sounded legit when I talked to him.
Legit is a relative term, I said. Henry slapped his knees and stood up.
Well, now that you've settled the matter, I'm off to bed. You kids can thumb-lock the door and pull it shut behind you when you leave. Take all the time you want.
Dietz set the cat on the floor and got to his feet. Across the front of his jeans there was a ghostly cat outlined in newly shed white hair.
I better be on my way. I'm at the Edgewater, scheduled for late arrival, but why risk them giving my room away?
He extended a hand to Henry, and the two men shook hands.
Thanks for supper. I owe you one.
Henry said,
good seeing you again. As long as you've come all this way, I hope you're staying a while.
Dietz made no response. Our good nights were superficial, not even accompanied by a perfunctory handshake or a neutral buss on the cheek. I was sorry he'd driven 9 hours to chew me out when I could have set him straight on the phone. I was about to suggest that he submit his bill to the probate court, assuming Pete Walensky'd died with a will, but I was certain the idea would occur to him without my piping up. At this point, it seemed best to leave well enough alone. I'd already done him a disservice without even meaning to. He waited until I'd unlocked my door and I was safely inside before he returned to the street. I heard him pass through the squeaky gate, and moments later, I heard his Porsche grumble to life. The sound faded as he drove off. I looked at my watch. It wasn't even 9 o'clock. Despite the long, hard day I'd endured, one more question remained. I picked up my jacket, my shoulder bag, and my car keys, locked the door behind me, and headed out again. I had Felix on my mind.
Chapter 24. When I reached the Santa Teresa Hospital, visiting hours had wound to a close, but there was still foot traffic in and out. The intensive care unit was quiet. I passed the empty waiting room. Even with the corridor lights dimmed, the business of life and death went on behind the scenes. This was the time for clerical work, charts to be caught up, supplies ordered, reports prepared for the shift change. There was no one in the hall. At the nurse's station, I inquired about Felix. A young Hispanic woman in blue scrubs got up from a rolling office chair and indicated that I was to follow.
Where'd Pearl disappear to?
She asked over her shoulder. Don't know. I'll have to look into it, I said. She had me wait in the hall while she slipped into Felix's room and pushed the curtain aside, sliding it along the track above his bed. She stood on the far side and watched him, as I did. Felix lay in a pool of light, attached to machinery that monitored and recorded his progress for good or for ill. Blood pressure, respiration, pulse. His head was heavily swaddled in white, both legs in casts. There was none of the usual inpatient detritus in range. No bed table, no flowers, no get-well cards propped up, no bucket of ice, and no oversized plastic cup with a flexible drinking straw. Life-sustaining fluids dripped into him from the clear bag that hung from the IV pole beside him, and waste fluids trickled into a container out of sight under his bed. His sheets were snowy. The light in the rest of the room was subdued. Poor Felix. The big boggart who'd stumbled into the camp while Pearl and Felix were trashing it must have known she was the instigator. Felix responded to life in the moment, ill-equipped to form a long-range plan and act on it. I could picture their desire to retaliate against Pearl, but why him? And why so savagely? Surely not for sport. Maybe this was better revenge from their perspective than attacking her directly. Where I stood, no sound reached me. Felix didn't move. Even the rise and fall of his breathing was difficult to discern. He was alive. He was safe. He was warm. He didn't seem to be in pain. Sleep was all that remained to him. So much of the stuff of life was already gone, leaving him undisturbed. Maybe he would swim into consciousness again, or maybe the gods would set him adrift. I kissed the tip of my index finger and pressed it to the glass. I'd come back the next day. Maybe by then he'd be surfacing from his long sleep. Sunday morning, by all rights, I should have slept in. Instead, I woke at 6, and while I didn't stir from my bed, I lay under the weight of my quilt and savored the warmth. The plexiglass skylight above my bed showed a half-dome of blue. I'd slept with my windows open to the full, and the morning air wafting in was scented with seaweed and burning leaves. Dietz was less than a mile away. He was one of those people who needs very little sleep. In the time we'd spent together, he was typically up until 2, down for 4 hours, and up again at 6. Sundays, in particular, he took a long time over coffee, reading the paper section by section, even the parts I skipped. I pushed the covers back, got up, and then turned and made the bed like a good girl. Live alone and you have 2 choices, be a tidy bun or a slob. I brushed my teeth, showered, and threw on the clothes I'd worn the night before. I drove to the Edgewater Hotel and left my Mustang in the hands of a parking valet. I went through the entrance to the hotel, crossed the lobby, and moved along the wide corridor with its stretches of oriental carpets over high-gloss Saltillo tiles. To my left, windows looked out onto an enclosed patio. Ficus trees, potted palms, and birds of paradise, like stiffly crested orange cranes, were arranged throughout, separating seating areas and providing the illusion of privacy. I spotted Dietz at a table against the stretch of windows that looked out toward the ocean. He was in jeans and a gray fleece shirt with a zippered placket and long sleeves that he'd pushed up. The paper was spread across the tabletop, one edge anchored by a coffee carafe. He wore round wire rim glasses. The hostess moved as though to greet me. I pointed at Dietz, indicating that I'd be sitting with him. She held up a menu that I waved off. Dietz looked up as I approached. He moved a hefty section of the Los Angeles Times from the nearest chair, and I sat down. I could see now that my initial take had been correct. He looked tired, and the gray in his hair had given way to white. He put his hand on the table, palm up, and gave me that crooked smile of his. I placed my hand in his. What happened to you? Naomi died. Of what? Cancer. It wasn't easy, but it was mercifully brief. 6 weeks from diagnosis to the end. The boys were there, and so was I. When was this? May 10th. I got back to Carson City on the 15th, and 4 days later, the call from Pete Walensky came in. If you'll pardon the hocus-pocus sentiment, it felt like a sign. There's no question I'd have done the work, anything to distract myself, but there was something in the idea it was coming from you. Naomi always said I used to work to avoid being close, a claim I hotly denied until the truth of it came home. Where are the boys at this point? Nick's in San Francisco, working for a brokerage firm. He graduated from Santa Cruz with a degree in accounting. Naomi steered him toward finance, and it seems to agree with him.
Graham got his degree this past December. He hung around with Nick for a while and then took off. He's footloose and fancy-free for the time being, at any rate.
Sounds like you.
He is like me. Nick was always more like Naomi. Her coloring, her temperament.
She got married, didn't she?
2 years ago. He's the one I feel for, poor bastard. Marriage was a good one from everything I heard. He'd lost his first wife to cancer, and he thought he'd survived the worst of it. Then Naomi got sick, and now he's right back where he was.
What about you?
She was my touchstone. Another revelation in the wake of her death. Whatever happened, I knew she'd be there. I couldn't live with the woman, but we had those two boys, and she was part of my life. I probably only saw her every 3 or 4 years. I'm off balance. They say it's like that when you lose a toe. You take for granted you can walk just fine. You've been doing it all your life without giving it a second thought. Suddenly, your gait goes wobbly.
He signaled the waitress, and I saw her moving toward the table with a fresh carafe of coffee.
Dietz got up and retrieved a coffee cup and silverware set up from the table next to us. It was a nice way of creating emotional space, so I could absorb what he'd said. I'd never met Naomi. I'd seen photographs of her, and I'd been startled by how beautiful she was. She and Dietz had been apart longer than they'd been a couple. They'd lived together for a time, but she'd refused to marry him. Or maybe he'd never asked. He returned to the table and sat down. I said, "The minute you walked into Henry's kitchen, I knew something was wrong. I could see it in your face. Surprise the hell out of me. This is what's so weird. We were never in love. There was some kind of chemistry I wouldn't even classify as sexual. It was more fundamental than that. Ours was a bad mix of personalities. We drove each other nuts. Happiest day of my life was when I left her the last time. Then she died and the bottom dropped out. I'm sorry. Being angry with you was a relief.
Easier than grief."
"Right," he said. "Look, I know you were mad that I left."
"Don't project. I wasn't that mad," I said.
"Could have fooled me. Times I thought about you, I didn't have the nerve to call. I figured you'd cut me down, and rightly so. After a while, the absence just seemed to compound itself. When Pete didn't pay me, I figured it was your revenge."
"Too subtle. If I take revenge, it'll have my name written all over it."
"So now what?"
"I could use some breakfast." "I'm starving," I said.
Dietz joined me in an orgy of bacon and eggs and all the accompaniments. It was a meal that never ceased to satisfy. I was still munching on a piece of buttered rye toast when he returned to the subject that had brought him to town. "So here's what bothers me," he said. "Pete hires me to do a job, and next thing you know, he's dead. What's that about?"
"Well, it wasn't quite like that," I said.
"You did the work when? The last weekend in May? The robbery went down in August." "I know. But I keep thinking the two might be linked. This isn't a gig you see much these days, one spouse spying on the other. We live in a land of no-fault divorce, so it struck me as odd."
"Why'd you take the job?"
"It sounded like fun. I can't remember the last time I was asked to skulk around a hotel taking pictures with a telephoto lens. I did a damn fine job of it, even if I say so myself. Then the guy who hired me gets shot to death, and I don't like it so much."
"Just because one event follows another doesn't mean the first caused the second," I said.
"I get that, and I hope you're right. But as long as I'm here, I'd like to satisfy myself."
"Tell me about the surveillance again. When you talked about it last night, I was feeling so defensive I didn't hear a word you said."
"I was tailing a woman named Mary Lee Bryce and her boss, a doctor named Dr. Linton Reed. Both work at a local research institute. Apparently they knew each other years ago and were involved in a romance of some kind. I have no idea if it was serious or not.
The point is, her current husband was worried about the two of them in Reno staying in the same hotel. Why'd they go to Reno? They attended a conference over the long holiday weekend. And was she having an affair with him? Not that I picked up on. The two barely spoke. Might be camouflage. I considered that. They ignore one another in public and bang away in private. Problem is, they had no personal contact at all. I'd be willing to swear to it.
Didn't you say she met with an old high school friend?
Now, see, you were listening, he said with a smile. You're right. A fellow named Owen Penske, an investigative journalist. I ran a background check on him. Big scandal in his past.
What kind?
He was fired from the New York Times for plagiarizing someone else's work.
What was he doing in Reno?
He lives there. He picked up a job at one of the Reno papers.
You think her relationship with him was business or personal?
I have no idea. She and Penske met twice, but I couldn't get audio. Place was too heavily populated. If I'd known in advance where they were meeting, I'd have planted a bug. I guarantee they didn't go to his room or hers.
But she could have been having an affair with him.
If so, the two of them did a flawless job of keeping it under wraps.
How did you frame it in your report?
I was careful. I drew no inferences, and I didn't offer my unsolicited opinion. Nice, neutral language not meant to inflame.
What are the ethics in a situation like this? With Pete dead, can you talk to her husband about whether the bill was paid?
I'll have to. I doubt the wife has any idea Pete hired me to keep an eye on her. I tip her off and the situation could turn ugly.
I still don't see what this has to do with Pete's death.
Feels like a fishing expedition. Sure it is, but why not? Somebody owes me.
Pete could have collected and just not paid you.
In which case, I'm probably out of luck. Meanwhile, I don't like thinking the guy got killed because of me. If there's no link, then fine. If I manage to collect my money, it's better yet.
You have a plan?
I'm hoping I can talk Pete's wife into letting us have a look at his accounts. Meanwhile, what's on your plate?
I have to get the Mustang over to the service station. Some asshole drove a roofing nail into my sidewall tire, I said. What about you?
I thought I'd pay Con Dolan a visit and see what he knows. Maybe the cops have a suspect in sight or one already in jail. If so, I'll quit worrying the job was in any way linked to his departure from the planet Earth.
You know where Con lives?
I do, and it shouldn't take me long. After that, if you're free, I'll treat you to dinner at Emile's.
Sounds good. You want me to check with Henry?
We'll save that for another occasion.
How long will you be here?
Don't know yet, he said.
After breakfast, we reclaimed our respective vehicles from the parking valet, and then he set off for Con Dolan's house, while I continued on to the nearest gas station where I dropped off my tire. The service bays were closed, but the two mechanics would be in Monday morning, and the fellow manning the pumps said he'd have one of them get on it first thing. He'd call when the tire had been fixed and was ready to be picked up. In the interim, the spare tire, while not optimal, was sufficient to get me around. That issue out of the way, the job I assigned myself was to round up Dandy and Pearl, who by all accounts were using Felix's precarious medical state as one more excuse to misbehave. I was reasonably certain the sports bar where they played darts on weekends was one called the Dugout I'd seen on Milagro, a block and a half past the mini-mart where I'd bought the 3 packs of cigarettes a lifetime ago. I found street parking around the corner from the Dugout and hoofed my way back. A judiciously placed waste container had done double duty as a trash can and as a barf receptacle for a patron who'd almost managed to reach it. The place was open, of course. 10 in the morning on a Sunday was the same as church to some folks. As this was the Pacific time zone, football games being broadcast from the Midwest and the East Coast would soon be underway. The bar itself looked like every other sports bar you've ever seen, Booths, freestanding tables and chairs, 6 big-screen television sets mounted at intervals, each tuned to a different sporting event. The bar itself extended the length of the room on the left-hand side, with stools lined up smartly, most of them occupied. A second room was furnished with foosball tables and pool tables. I caught a glimpse at the rear of a series of dartboards, but no one was throwing at that hour. 12 men at the bar turned to look at me as I walked in and then went back to their drinks. The bartender ambled in my direction. He was a middle-aged man, short and stocky, wearing chinos and a vintage jersey of some vague hockey-like sort. He placed a cocktail napkin on the bar in front of me. I said, "I'm looking for Pearl."
"Too late. Her and Dandy came in yesterday, kicking up a fuss. Now they're 86th.
Being 86th was the drunkard's equivalent of being barred for life, though most bar owners would eventually relent. You know where they went?
Shape they were in, it wasn't Harbor House. Curfew's at 7. Last I saw them, it was 2 a.m.
They were here all that time?
They went out for a while and then came back in, spreading the joy, I guess.
What kind of trouble did they make? Mockingly, he put a hand to his chin. He twiddled his fingers and looked skyward as though trying to remember and calculate.
Well, let's see. Second time they showed up, they started knocking back shots. Dandy's not a maudlin drunk like she is, but he gets in everyone's face. He's a guy who wants to engage in long, rambling chats. Folks don't want to deal with that. The two of them tried throwing darts, but neither one could see straight. Pearl fell over backward and busted up a chair, and then he weighed in and broke a second one for good luck. She got sick, and then he fell down. I should have called the cops at that point, but I got too big a heart.
I heard they were on a bender.
I can testify to that. Here's the deal. I like Pearl. I wish her the best, and I mean that. Who knows what put me where I am and put her on the street? Call it the fickle finger of fate, but she's wanking on about how everything's so unfair. I got no patience for that. Like I said to her, I didn't invent the game and I didn't make the rules. Maybe it all stinks and I'm sorry as hell, but I got a bar to run.
She's a tough one, I said, hoping to diffuse his irritation and sidestep an argument.
She says she's down on her luck, but luck's got nothing to do with it. She makes choices the same as I do. I don't know if she's lazy or stupid or mentally ill, and I don't care. Point is, I got 15 employees dependent on me. But how the hell can I run a business when Pearl and her ilk come in here and puke all over the place?
I shook my head, saying, "I hear you," in what I hoped was a sympathetic tone. In truth, I was more interested in their current whereabouts than a history of their bad behavior.
Fact is, my taxes pay for her room and board and her medical care. You ever think about that? And you know what? My wife got sick and ended up in St. Terry's for 10 days. You want to know how much that cost me? $90,000. I kid you not. I'll be paying that off until I'm 90 myself. Pearl gets sick. It's not going to cost her a dime. They got programs, shelter and clothing and 3 meals a day. I should be so unfortunate. Point is, I'm done with her and I'm done with her friend. Tell you something else, and this makes no sense. Dandy's a smart guy. His father taught math at the high school. You ever hear about that?
Actually, I did.
Dandy could have made something of himself, you know? He decides to take the low road. Why does that obligate me?
I made a few more mouth noises and then excused myself. Raise the subject of the homeless and everybody has a strong opinion. 50% of the local citizens are sympathetic, and the other 50 are pissed as hell. Does the problem get solved? No, it does not. I retrieved my car and headed back down Milagro toward the beach, hanging a right when I reached the small side street where Harbor House was located. Again, I parked the car, hoofed the half block, and went in. The common room was largely empty, but there they were,
Pearl and Dandy, sprawled on adjacent couches, both of them dead to the world. She had her jacket pulled over her head, but her body type was distinct. I couldn't miss the bulk of her swaddled in fake leather. Dandy reclined in an upholstered chair, hands clasped across his lap, his legs extended in front of him. He was slack-mouthed and snoring. The air around them smelled of fruitcake. I found a chair and watched for a while, wondering at the life they led. I couldn't handle it myself. I don't have the discipline. I might manage to be idle for half a day, and then I'd be back in my routine. Getting up at 6, jogging my 3 miles, going into the office, walking up to Rosie's for a bite to eat. Doing nothing makes me itch. I don't have the temperament or the strength of character. After a few moments, Pearl roused herself and sat up. Her face was high blood pressure pink, her hair as stiff and dry as straw. She'd bleached it blonde once upon a time, and what was left had worked its way down to the tips. In the wake of her drinking binge, I could tell that many of her elementary body parts were in full mutiny. I didn't feel sorry for her, but I could identify to some extent. She must have felt she'd been stricken with a tropical disease, some hideous malady she'd done nothing to deserve. I could see her looking inward, perhaps measuring her nausea level on a scale of 1 to 10. I would have pegged her at a 6 and rising. "How are you feeling?" I asked. She said, "Man, oh man." She ran a hand across her face and peered at me as though the light hurt her eyes. "Where'd you come from?"
"Back from Bakersfield."
"How'd it go?"
"Not that well. What about you?"
"I think I picked up that stomach bug that's going around."
"It's a bad one from what I hear."
She held a hand up. "Hang on a sec."
She pushed herself to her feet. She pressed 2 fingers against her lips and walked with great purpose toward the ladies' room, speeding up as she got closer. Even with the door closed, I could hear the misery. Such are the charms of drink. Dandy would be lucky if he managed to sleep for a while, letting his body metabolize the excess alcohol in his poor, beleaguered system. Pearl was moving slowly when she returned. I could tell she'd splashed some water on her face, and I was hoping she'd had a chance to rinse her mouth. She eased herself back down on the couch by degrees as though her back had gone out on her. "Word has it you and Dandy got 86th from the dugout," I said mildly.
"Won't last. You know why?"
"I'd love to hear your analysis."
"Guy's got a big heart. Besides, he likes me."
"He'd have to."
"Anyway, what did we do to him? Hey, so once in a while we mess up, but who don't? Doesn't," she said.
She slid a pained look in my direction, and I imagined I was the only thing standing between her and another round of sleep.
"You stopped by for some reason in particular?" she asked.
"Just wondering where you were. Last night I went over to St. Terry's to see Felix."
"Bummer," she said. "I've been there for hours. Anyone tell you that?"
"I heard you were faithful as a hound."
"You got that right. You don't happen to have any Vicodin?"
I shook my head in the negative.
"Percocet?"
"Fresh out," I said. I heard the phone ringing at the desk behind me. Someone picked up, and when I glanced over my shoulder, I saw a volunteer standing with her palm across the mouthpiece.
"Pearl?"
She held up the handset by way of summons.
"What did I tell you?"
she said, struggling to her feet again.
"Guy owes me an apology big time. I don't know if I'm accepting it or not. I don't like abuse, especially when I didn't do nothing to him."
"Well, good luck," I said. "Show the guy some mercy," Pearl said.
"Ha!"
Meanwhile, Dandy had pulled himself upright. Maybe our conversation had reached him in the depths of his inebriated state. As much as he'd had to drink, he wouldn't be sober for another 2 days. If Pearl's condition was a harbinger, he'd be in a hurt locker the size of hers. From the direction of the desk, I heard Pearl's voice rise.
Do not say that! Don't you say that to me, you son of a bitch!
There was a silence, and Pearl's voice rose.
Shut your trap! That is not true! You're a lying sack of shit!
Another silence while someone on the other end had a few more things to say. Pearl's response was to the point.
Hey, you say that again, I'll come down there and punch you in the face!
She listened briefly and then slammed down the handset.
That's bullshit! What kind of bullshit is that?
She headed toward us at a lumbering pace, still in too much pain to move with any speed. She was sweating, and her skin had turned blotchy in the wake of her rage. Dandy pushed himself to his feet.
What's up?
He asked.
I'll tell you what's up. You want to know what's up? That asshole's telling me Felix died.
I saw him last night, I said.
Yeah, well, he died an hour ago. How could he do that when I love the guy? Hey, you know what? Hey.
Her voice broke. Whatever she meant to add, a howl went up instead. The sound was sufficient to freeze everyone in place, and then send half the residents scurrying to her aid as though her hand had been caught in the blades of a fan. Chapter 25. Here's how hard-hearted I am. I was irritated by Pearl's wailing. It seemed pumped up, artificial, overdone. My response was to disconnect, as though I were pulling a plug out of a wall socket. I couldn't react to the news of Felix's death, because her excess had shut me down. It was as though she'd preempted any honest feelings generated by his passing. At the same time, I wondered if Pearl was the normal one, and I was too psychologically stunted to experience sorrow. This didn't seem like the proper moment to sort out questions of such complexity, but the idea had occurred to me on previous occasions, this sense that I was somehow out of step with the rest of humankind. Maybe I'd seen too much. Maybe I'd been exposed to matters so coarse and wrenching I was no longer capable of feeling pain. I could almost picture myself in a therapist's office, gingerly picking my way across this minefield. Was I nuts? Nah, I was almost sure it was Pearl. If I were that screwed up, I wouldn't be capable of reflecting on the point, would I? So there I stood while she collapsed on the couch in what looked like a parody of grief. Granted, it's not my job to judge how others process emotions, but I gave her a 2.5 out of 10 on the basis of her phoniness. Dandy made no move to comfort her. I wasn't sure if he felt equally alienated or he was simply helpless in the face of female histrionics. I didn't doubt Pearl loved Felix. I just thought she was cranking up the theatrics so she could command center stage. I crossed my arms and kept my gaze on the floor, knowing my body language testified to my state of mind, which was cranky and withdrawn. I could have sworn Pearl was aware of my disconnect because she took to thrashing about like a kid in the throes of a temper tantrum, determined to get a rise out of Mom. Someone brought her a glass of water. Someone wet a paper towel and gently dabbed her face. I wanted to slap the shit out of her, but somehow managed to restrain myself. This went on for longer than was absolutely necessary to make her point clear. Two of the residents helped her to her feet, and she was led from the room like an athlete injured on the playing field. The others stood by in respectful silence, while I mentally crossed my eyes. Dandy and I exchanged a look, but I couldn't read the content. I said, "What in the world happened while I was off in Bakersfield? I know those guys beat the shit out of Felix, but what precipitated the attack? Did he and Pearl find some way to add insult to injury?
Not that I know. Pearl mostly stayed here, worried they'd come after her. Felix didn't seem concerned. I don't think the notion that actions have consequences meant anything to him. He did what he did and then forgot about it. That boy wasn't blessed with much in the way of common sense.
What have the police done about the Boggarts?
Asked around, I'm sure. Filled out paperwork. I know they talked to the fellow who called 911, but he won't help. Sorry it happened and so forth, but he's not sticking his neck out for a bum who gets in a brawl with three other bums.
Meanwhile, you and Pearl go off on a toot, I said. What was that about? You'd think the last thing you'd want to do is get shit-faced.
Sheepishly, he said, feels good sometimes, you know. When bad things go down, you want to cut loose. Get loaded and forget. Better than feeling sad or mad or depressed.
Are you okay now? You don't look good.
No, I'm not feeling so hot. I need to find me a spot where I can curl up and sleep.
You'll keep an eye on Pearl?
Oh, sure. Gotta look after my pal.
You go off on another bender and I'll wring your neck, I said with all the compassion I could muster, which was none. Then I repressed the urge to hug the man, primarily because he had what looked like a streak of spit up down the front of his shabby sport coat. I patted him on the arm. The gesture was weak, but it was the best I could do. On my way out, the volunteer at the desk beckoned to me. I checked behind me to make sure she meant the gesture for me. I paused at the desk. She said,
"Are you related to Terence Days?"
"Yes."
"The one he made executor of his estate?"
"That's me. I'm Kinsey."
"Belva," she said. "The reason I ask is I came across some mail for him and thought you should have it."
"Well, thanks. That's good of you." She turned and picked up a couple of bank statements in windowed envelopes and a 14x20 mailing pouch. The package was thick, and when she passed it across the counter to me, I was surprised by the weight. The label was self-addressed in the printing I'd come to recognize. The postmark was June 29th, 1988. "I appreciate this," I said. I pulled out a business card and placed it on the desk for her.
"If anything else comes in, would you let me know?"
"Of course. I'll leave a note for the other volunteers in case there's something more." I thanked her and carried the bulky package to my car. The package was so plastered over with clear tape that I couldn't make any headway. I'd have to wait and open it later to see what he'd shipped to himself months before he died. I sat for a while. No point in consigning Felix's death to an index card. I wasn't sure what time he'd died or what the attending physician had listed as the cause of death. I didn't even know how old he was. All I knew for a certainty was that he'd never get his braces off, and that seemed too sad for words. I turned the key in the ignition and headed toward the bike shop at the foot of State Street. I turned into a side street just shy of the intersection and found a parking place. I locked my car and walked around the corner to the bicycle rental shop. The weekend art show was in progress, paintings, ceramics, and assorted crafts displayed in a line of booths laid out alongside the walk. Some vendors had erected lightweight tents to display homemade articles of clothing, wind chimes, lawn ornaments, jewelry, and whirligigs. Given that it was Sunday afternoon and the sun was out, the beach beyond was littered with people, screaming children, joggers with dogs, and prone lasses who'd loosened the tops of their bikinis to avoid the tan lines. The restaurants along the boulevard had flung their doors open, and those establishments with outside seating were filled to capacity. The bicycle rental shop was doing a lively business as well, especially with their pedal surreys, which were always popular with kids. I went in, In addition to bike rentals, the shop sold surfboards, bathing suits, T-shirts, shorts, ball caps, sunglasses, sunscreen, and accessories. I looked for someone in charge and settled on a fellow in his 60s who stood at the cash register, ringing up a sale. His Hawaiian shirt was one of those with washed-out colors, shades of pale blue with a design of palm fronds picked out in white. He was balding and wore a pair of reading glasses on top of his head. He sported a wedding ring and a wristwatch that looked sturdy enough to flush down a toilet without losing time. I moved to the counter and waited my turn. When he'd finished with the customer, he looked at me expectantly. I held out my hand. "Kinsey Milhone," I said. "Are you the owner?" My introducing myself put me in a category with traveling salesmen and promoters hoping to post a flyer advertising a little theater production no one wanted to attend. After a slight hesitation, he shook my hand. "I own the place, yes. Last name's Puckett. What can I do for you?" "I'm a friend of the young man who got beat up out front." His smile dimmed.
"You're talking about Felix. How's he doing?"
"Not that well. He died a little while ago." He held up a hand.
"Hold it. Before you get into your spiel, I know what you want and I can't help. Those goons kicked the shit out of him, and I'm sorry he died, but I'm not going to go down to the station to look at mugshots. I know who they are. I see 'em down here all the time. What's it to you?"
I didn't know Felix well, but I feel bad.
"Me too. Who wouldn't? He was a good kid, but that doesn't change the facts. I'm sick to death of the homeless population. If they're not hitting up the tourists for change, they're passed out between buildings or parked on public benches talking to themselves. I don't begrudge a guy a place to sleep. What gets my goat is every night I got someone peeing on my front step. It smells like a urinal out there. I got some gal takes a dump out by my fence every single night. What kind of person does that?
Maybe she's mentally ill.
Then maybe she should be put away somewhere. Worst thing ever happened was Reagan closing down all the loony bins back in the 70s.
I cut him off. "Let's not get into politics, okay? I understand your complaints, but I'm not here to debate. I'd like to talk about Felix, not the rest of this stuff."
"Point taken. The kid was never disrespectful, so I don't mean to tar him with the same brush. Homeless in general, I got no beef with as long as they lay off what's mine. Town's filled with weepy-minded liberals." "Hey, sorry. I didn't mean to go off again," he said. "Comes down to identifying the assholes who throttled him, I got nothing to say. That big goon gets picked up, what's the system gonna do with him? Run him through the courts and spit him out the other end."
"But why should those guys get away with murder?" I asked. "Homeless or not, those are bad men."
"I agree," he said. "Let me tell you something. I knew Felix a lot longer than you did. First time he showed up was 6 or 8 years back. He couldn't have been more than 16 years old. He asked for a couple of bucks and I turned him down. I said I needed work done and was he willing or not? He said yes, so I let him sweep up. He'd break down boxes, take out trash, and stuff like that. In exchange, I'd buy him dinner. Nothing fancy, but it wasn't fast food. Sometimes I'd slip him a 10 to see him through until his disability check came in. After a while, I guess he lost interest or found some other way to make ends meet. I'm sorry about what happened to him."
"But you still won't look at mugshots."
"No, I will not. You know what I'd get in return? That two-bit gangster and his cronies would come in here looking for me, punch my lights out, smash my plate glass windows, pull merchandise off the racks and stuff it down their pants. Where does that leave me?"
"Would you at least think about it?"
"No, because nothing's going to change. Not you, not me, not that kid's death. I get your point. You'd like to do what you can. Me too, for that matter, but I won't put myself in harm's way. I got a wife and kids, and they come first. You might think I'm a coward, but I'm not."
"I understand. I just can't think what else to do for him."
I appreciate the sentiment. This is nothing against you or Felix. I know my limits. That's all I'm trying to say.
I took out a business card and placed it on the counter. If anything else comes up, could you give me a call?
No. But I wish you luck.
When I returned to the studio, I passed Dietz's red Porsche parked half a block away. Either he hadn't found Condolin at home, or information had been in short supply. There was a parking place on the far side of the street, so I made a U-turn and pulled into it. I grabbed my shoulder bag and the mailing pouch, locked my car, crossed the street, and let myself in through the gate. When I reached the back patio, I stopped dead. Henry sat in one of the two Adirondack chairs. Anna Dace had settled in the other. Her dark hair was pulled up on top of her head and held in place with a series of silver clips. Boots, jeans, a denim jacket, under which she wore a low-cut T-shirt. All well and good. It was the oversized suitcase beside her that caught my attention. I also took note of Ed the cat, who was curled up in her lap, sleeping like a baby. I held Dace's package against my chest like body armor as I stared at her.
How did you get here?
A Greyhound bus.
I thought you didn't have a dime.
I had to borrow the money from Ellen. If you'd given me a ride, like you said, I wouldn't have had to bother her.
I never said I'd give you a ride.
You sure as shit didn't say no.
She glanced at Henry.
Excuse the trash talk, but I'm sure you can see my point.
He had the good grace not to comment one way or the other. He ventured a smile at me.
Your father's side of the family. This is nice.
I was still focused on her.
You can't stay with me.
Who asked you? I got a place to stay,
Henry said.
It's no trouble. I have a spare bedroom. We were just going in to get her settled. I thought you'd enjoy having her close by so the two of you could get to know each other.
Did you come up with that plan, or did she? Henry blinked.
I don't quite remember now. I thought I did.
I have work to do, I said. I hadn't given Dietz a key, but he must have hung on to the one he had made when he was last in town. The apartment was unlocked, and the door stood ajar, leaving a plank of October sunshine lying on my floor. I had to stand in the doorway for a moment to regain my self-control. I couldn't blame Henry. How was he to know how manipulative she was? I put the package on the desk. Dietz was sitting on my couch, bare feet propped on the coffee table, while he worked his way through my copy of the Sunday Los Angeles Times. This was the very paper he had open across the breakfast table when I'd found him at the Edgewater earlier. He'd put on a fresh pot of coffee, and his empty cup was resting within reach.
You're upset.
No, I'm not.
You look upset.
I don't want to talk about it, I said. It has nothing to do with you.
Imagine my relief.
I tossed my shoulder bag onto one of the kitchen stools and settled on the couch beside him. I should have let you finish reading the paper while you had the chance, I said. He smiled.
I can do this all day.
I like the bits and pieces buried at the back.
I check the personals columns and study the car ads. You never know when you might come across the deal of the century.
What did Con say?
He wasn't home. Neighbor said he and Stacy Oliphant went off to Cabo for a couple of weeks. Sport fishing, I gather. We'll chat with the homicide detectives tomorrow and hope they have information to trade. Your old boyfriend still assigned to the Crimes Against Persons Unit?
Who? Jonah? He was never a boyfriend. He was a guy I dated when his wife wasn't jerking him around.
Really? I don't think I knew about him. I was talking about the other one. Curly-haired fellow whose dad has all the dough.
Doesn't ring a bell, I said,
though I knew perfectly well he was referring to Cheney Phillips.
I wasn't sure how he could contemplate the subject of my so-called love life. If I'd known he'd been involved with two other women, I'd have been too insecure to mention either one. In my opinion, this was exactly the sort of issue that lengthy and frequent separations bring to the fore.
I didn't want to share. I was an only child, and I still tend to cling to the notion of what's mine is mine. Actually, Dietz was an only child as well, but he'd gone to the other extreme. Where I was possessive, he was laissez-faire, a free-market kind of guy. I knew it was his coping mechanism, but I wasn't sure how it worked. Maybe he was casual about bonds because he was always out the door and always moving on. He had no interest in putting down roots. To him, life was a slideshow, and he was happy with the change of scene. He liked stimulation and novelty. He didn't attach emotional meaning to what I did, especially since he felt it had nothing to do with him. I don't understand how men can operate like that. Given my abandonment issues, and I confess I hate talk of that sort, I was always in danger of losing what I longed for most. Stability, closeness, belonging. In my head, I knew better. Being needy is actually a way of keeping others at bay. It may seem attractive to those addicted to rescue, but the yearning can never be fulfilled, and the clinging ends up driving folks away. Why would you want someone hanging around your neck, worried you don't care enough, and asking for constant reassurance on the point? I think we should do something, I said.
Like what?
I don't know. Let's get out of here. He folded the paper and put his bare feet on the floor, feeling around for his loafers.
I'm game, though I'd prefer to have a plan.
I'm thinking we should take a look at Pete's office. Maybe he actually has a partner with a shitload of cash. You can collect and be on your way.
I didn't say I was leaving.
But you will.
You have a bad attitude.
I know. But it's the only one I have.
We took Dietz's car to avoid the wear and tear on my spare tire. The drive into town was a simple matter of taking Cabana to State and hanging a left. Pete's office was on Granita, in a building that had seen better days. We found street parking in a small lot nearby. The neighborhood was funky. The entire block would doubtless be bought someday soon, raised and replaced with a more lucrative concern. A parking garage, a condominium complex, a hotel of a modest chain. Pete's ground floor office was marked A. The agency had apparently never been graced with a sign hanging out front. The names Abel and Walensky were still lettered on the plate glass window in black and gold decals that had largely flaked and fallen away. In the lower right-hand corner, a for-lease sign had been propped with a contact number. There was no realtor or property manager mentioned by name. Dietz jotted down the phone number while I peered through the glass. The office consisted of one large room with a closet. I was guessing he had access to the executive restroom located down the hall and open to the public. His space was bare of furniture. The closet door stood open, revealing an empty hanging rod and a few makeshift shelves. There was a second door in the middle of the back wall that probably opened into an interior corridor. Knowing Pete as I did, I imagined a number of hasty departures when circumstances warranted his absenting himself on short notice. As this was Sunday, the offices on either side of his were closed. "You want to track down the property manager?" Dietz asked.
"I'd rather see if Pete's wife is available." I remembered Pete's home address from the days when the Birdshine Agency was still in business. While I was accruing my training hours, I also made coffee and ran errands for the two. If Pete was late turning in a report, I'd be sent over to pick up the paperwork. The Walensky house was 10 blocks away, a story and a half of white frame with a small recessed porch barely large enough for the two dusty white wicker chairs arranged to one side. Two sets of double windows sat one above the other. A single diamond-shaped pane to the right suggested attic space.
The window frames and the trim pieces around the front door were painted dark blue. An enormous eucalyptus tree in the front yard was leaning drunkenly to one side, where the edge of the porch prevented its upright growth. I twisted the handle on the mechanical doorbell. The resultant response mimicked an alarm clock going off. Ruthie Walensky opened the door. I hadn't seen her for many years, but she looked much the same, tall, very slim, with long, thinning hair brushed away from her face. She wore a long-sleeve white lace blouse and a long denim skirt with boots. She was easily 60 years old, and while the headband might have looked incongruous on anyone else, it was perfect on her. Her hair color had shifted from mild brown to gray, with much of the original shade still in evidence. Her brows were pale over mild green eyes. Soft lines defined her elongated face with its high forehead. When she saw me, recognition flickered. But it had been far too long for her to recall my name. "Kinsey Milhone," I said. "Pete and I were professional acquaintances years ago." "I remember you," she said as her gaze shifted to Dietz. "This is my colleague, Robert Dietz." Her gaze returned to mine. "You know, Pete was shot to death in August. I heard about that, and I'm sorry." Already I admired the straightforward manner in which she conveyed the information. No euphemisms, no attempt to soften the facts. "Is there a problem?" she asked. Dietz said, "I'm a Nevada PI. I did some work for Pete last May, a 4-day surveillance in a Reno hotel. There's a balance outstanding on the account."
"You'll have to get in line with everyone else. Pete died without a penny to his name. His creditors are still swarming out of the woodwork.
We're hoping to pursue another approach, one that won't involve you," I said. She stared for a moment, making up her mind, and then held open the wooden screen door.
"You're welcome to come in. I'm not liable for his debts, but I don't mind listening to what you have to say."
Dietz and I stepped into the foyer. There was a living room to our left, and she led the way to a small seating area. Dietz and I sat side by side on an upholstered settee that probably didn't get much use. I suspected she occupied cozier rooms at the back of the house. "How are you doing?" I asked. "It must be difficult."
"I'm getting along well enough, though every other day a new problem seems to crop up."
"Such as what?"
"People like you arriving at my door," she said.
Her smile was slight and carried no rebuke.
"I've stopped opening his mail. There's no point in knowing about bills when there's nothing I can do."
"What are the police telling you?"
"Not much. They were interested at first. Now other cases have taken precedence."
"No suspect?" She shook her head.
"They think he was killed with his own gun, which was missing from the scene. He took his Glock and his Smith & Wesson with him everywhere, especially if he went out at night. He wouldn't have been without one or the other. Usually he carried both."
"Both of his guns are gone?"
"Just the Glock. His pocket pistol was returned to me. They found that in the trunk of his car. They believe there was a second gun involved, also missing. A Lieutenant Phillips is handling the case. I'm sure he could tell you more."
"You have no idea why he was out that night?"
"He was an insomniac. So he was out many nights, roaming the streets. There was nothing unusual about that night, at least as far as I know."
"No business dealings that might have gone sour?"
"He mentioned a job coming up, and he was optimistic about his prospects. I have no idea what came of it."
"What about friends? Was there anyone he might have confided in?"
"You knew Pete. He was a loner. He didn't have friends or confidants," Dietz said.
"Were you aware he was in financial straits?"
"I suspected as much, though his affairs are in much worse shape than I thought. He'd let his life insurance lapse. He had nothing in savings, his checking account was in overdraft, and his credit cards were maxed out. I knew he had problems, but I had no idea of the magnitude. When we got married, we swore we'd be honest with one another. But his pride sometimes got in the way. The house is paid for, but both our names are on the deed. I haven't talked to an attorney, but I'm hoping I won't have to sell or take out a mortgage to satisfy his creditors.
Did he leave a will?
I haven't found one so far. That was the sort of thing he postponed. In his mind, there was always time.
What about assets? Dietz said. I'm not asking from self-interest. I'm wondering if there's anything you might have overlooked.
I'm surprised he hadn't filed for bankruptcy. I have two accounts in my name that he had no access to, or he might have gone through those as well. It was easy come, easy go with him.
A free spirit, I suggested.
Not free from my perspective, she said tartly. I noted the flash of heat with a feeling of relief. She was keeping her anger in check, but it was there. She went on, her gaze fixed on the floor. 2 months ago, he told me he was setting money aside for our anniversary. Next year would have been our 40th, and he wanted us to go on a river cruise. I didn't take him seriously, but I was hoping he'd manage to tuck a little something away. If I could lay hands on anything, I could at least pay the noisiest of his creditors.
You haven't found anything?
She shook her head. I've turned this house upside down, and there's nothing except for the $22 worth of coins he tossed in a jar.
No investments?
Oh, please. No stocks, no bonds, no annuities, she said. He drove a Ford Fairlane with over 200,000 miles on the odometer. The police impounded the car at the scene, but it's since been returned. I sold it for $100, and I was delighted to get that much. The new owner's picking it up later in the week. It's parked out back if you'd like to take a look. Maybe he stashed a winning lottery ticket in the glove compartment.
Her tone carried a touch of irony, but she wasn't being sarcastic or self-mocking. She must have been appalled at the position he'd left her in. Dietz said, "What about you? Do you work?"
"I'm a private duty nurse. I make more than adequate money for my personal needs. Even if I'm forced to mortgage the house, I'll be fine. But it's not what I pictured at this stage of my life."
"I'm sorry we've had to burden you with this along with everything else," he said.
"How much did he owe you?"
"A little more than $3,000, she said.
"I apologize."
"Not your fault," Dietz said.
"You mentioned another approach."
Dietz said, "A long shot. It's possible Pete hadn't been paid for the job he'd subbed out to me. If we can take a look at his files, we might find his account receivables and collect from the client instead of having to worry you."
"If someone owed him money, wouldn't the income count as part of his estate?"
"All I know is I did the work and I'd like to be paid."
She considered the request and then seemed to shrug. "There are files in the garage. He'd been carting home boxes a few at a time over a period of weeks. I realize now he was worried about being evicted and wanted to be prepared." She rose to her feet. "You can follow me, if you like."
Chapter 26. On the way through the house, she picked up a set of car keys from a kitchen drawer. We followed her across a yard that was stripped down and unadorned. The grass, already in its dormant phase, had turned a dispirited shade of brown. It was clear neither she nor Pete had made any effort outdoors.